Hey everybody, this is Rob. I'm here with Jason, and this is a special bonus episode of Building the Game, and we are talking today with an extra special guest. I'm a big fan of his. We have on the line with us here Ross Payton, the host of Role Playing Public Radio. Hey Ross.
Hello.
How are you?
Hi, this is Ross Payton with Role Playing Public Radio.
He does that so much better than you do.
Oh man, he's a dynamo. Yeah. Yeah, we're so happy to have you on the show, man. Thank you so much for hanging out with us for a little while.
Sure, no problem. I'm always happy to ramble on about game design and podcasting and all that good stuff. So,
you've picked the right show then, because that's what we love to do.
Yeah, no doubt about it. For anybody who doesn't know, like I said, Ross is the host of Role Playing Public Radio. Can you kind of give us the elevator pitch maybe for what your show's all about?
Role Playing Public Radio, really there are two aspects to it. One is the main podcast where we do my co-host and I, Tom Church, do a show where we go over gaming topics, specifically to tabletop role-playing games, not video games. But, I mean, we do mention that stuff, but the focus is advice, reviewing different game systems, talking about how to run games in different genres, how to deal with problem players, and we also review products that are of interest to gamers, and we occasionally do interviews and record panels from conventions. And then we also have RPPR Actual Play, where I record game sessions with my local group and with a Zoom H2 recorder, and then I just post these game sessions online so people can hear, listen to our campaigns of Dungeons & Dragons, Eclipse Phase, and Wild Talents, which is a superhero role-playing game. We have many one-shots in like Call of Cthulhu and other role-playing games. So we kind of try to keep them mixed up. And occasionally we do comedy bits and things like that. So there's a couple side projects like Raylery, where every once in a while I do a video game project, and we started going into video. But that's the main idea. So there's two sort of aspects to it, but the main podcast and then the actual play.
Right on. Yeah, and I can say I'm a big fan of both. I was so sad when King Seamoss died, but then he came back, so it was all better.
Yes.
Yeah.
That was, from the D&D New World campaign. That,
yeah.
That sort of endeared a lot of people to us.
Yeah.
And it's interesting how our gradually changed our group composition, sort of changed. You know, when a lot of people like Cody, who's one of our players, but now he's too busy to game anymore since he has a full-time job and a wife and all that.
Yeah.
And but we've got new players in there like Caleb, and he's mm-hmm. been running Eclipse Phase, and he's built up his own fan base. So it's always interesting to see just how it's gradually evolved over the years. So.
Yeah, I'm really enjoying the Eclipse Phase campaign, too. Caleb has some crazy awesome ideas in that show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, he really does.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, how'd you get into gaming?
Well, I mean, I've been gaming, obviously, since I was a kid. For role-playing games, it was really... The first role-playing game I ever played was actually Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Other Strangeness, which is probably not the best game to start with. Palladium system is a bit antiquated, and even back then it was sort of showing its age, although I didn't know any better. And my first character was this mutant raccoon ninja biker, and he died. He blew up in the very first session I ever played him, but for some reason that hooked me. And I started reading up on Dungeons & Dragons, and then getting into other games, and I've kind of stuck with it ever since. I like the idea of being able to write, to create, and so that's how I got started.
Yeah, so you really hooked into it because of that creation approach?
Yeah, well, something creating your own characters and just imagining these worlds, and I just feel like an urge to create or to write and to imagine, so yeah.
Yeah, and then you've translated that into your career, right? You're a professional game designer and writer.
Yes.
Yes, which is super cool, and I'm way jealous of that.
Yes, my it's not quite as glamorous. I mean, I spend most days writing at home, and it's there's the trying to get new contracts, trying to get more work, and then marketing yourself and blah blah blah. So it's I get to do what I love. So I mean, it kind of balances out.
Yeah, that's really fantastic. It's got to take a lot of guts to go for that.
I've been very lucky that my family's been very supportive, and I've had a lot of friends who are very supportive. And the podcast wouldn't work if I didn't have a lot of friends who were able to contribute and make it as popular as it is. You know, without Cody's, without Caleb's, and without Tom's contributions, the other people's contributions, it wouldn't be where it is. Mm-hmm. And I've been very lucky to have the chance to try and throw myself out in that path. So, and I've been fairly fortunate. So
yeah, cool. Why did you end up starting the podcast? What was the impetus for that?
The podcast, we officially started it in 2007. That's the Tom and I, talking and doing kind of the regular thing where we hash over gaming topics. But before that, for about 2 years, from 2005, 2007, every once in a while, my friends and I would get together and we would record. I don't know if you go to RPG.net, they have these forums. And
yeah,
one person on there is called AB3, and he wrote these radio play kind of stories that were, they're stories about his gaming career that were all very screwed up, very dysfunctional, people that were just, the stories were very funny, like playing riffs at the Denny's, late at night and trying to hit on the waitress while you're shooting, mutants in power armor. These stories written in a radio play format where every character has their dialogue and it just goes back and forth. And so I don't know exactly why, we say, hey, why don't we record this? That would be fun. All right. So we record it. Everybody records the voices and I put it together and we just sort of threw it on the internet and we thought it was funny. And then I went to Gen Con. And so we did that from about 2005, 2007. And I didn't really have a website set up for that. And we didn't really have hosting for it. But in 2007, I went to Gen Con for the first time and I was like, there's all this stuff. It was very, very cool. Tom and I both went, and along with a few other people from Springfield. And we, after that, I was like, yeah, let's just do a regular show and let's just, And it sort of went on from there. And then it was kind of, and then once we, about a year later, of course, 4th Ed Dungeons & Dragons came out. And we started doing our own 4th Ed D&D campaign, the New World campaign, which lasted for like 47 sessions by the end. And we are 46 sessions, and we sort of I started recording and posting on the podcast, and people loved that. And I was like, oh wow, people really are responding to this, so let's just keep doing it. It's sort of been like a positive feedback cycle where we get comments, we get feedback from people, and that sort of motivates me to keep going. And so yeah, it's just kind of keep gradually building on.
So it sounds like it grew pretty organically then.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Definitely. There was never like a plan. Like in 2007, I will become a podcasting god, and I shall have, the ransom model and crowdfunding was kind of in its infancy.
Yeah,
weren't really doing it like they are now, and so yeah,
that's cool. That kind of,
yeah.
Yeah, man. I didn't know. I didn't know that the actual play had started with the New World campaign.
Well, we had done. I had done some actual plays before that, but they're all one shots. That was the first campaign.
Oh, okay.
If you go on the RP, like there's still like an archive of like 31 actual play episodes that are on the main RPPR side. Not all. I didn't transfer them to the main RPPR actual play side. Okay. And the reason I made that actual play size is because people were complaining that, like, I like the show, but I don't like the actual plays. I like the actual plays, but I don't like the show. And so I was like, I'll just put two podcasts on there, I'll just make so people can choose what they want. And so I'd recorded some one shots, Little Fears and Call Cthulhu, and that was fun. But I just noticed I started getting a lot more hits with the New World campaign, a lot more feedback, and a lot more people really digging the campaign style. So that's sort of, oh wow, that really was noticeable to me. So
cool.
Because I think it was also, we were probably one of the first podcasts to do an actual play of 4th Ed. It was brand new and people were, there's a lot of excitement about it.
Yeah.
And people wanted to see what it was about.
Yeah, plus you guys stuck it out. I mean, you, like you said, 47 episodes, you did the whole campaign. A lot of other actual plays that I tried listening to, they just kind of petered out and gave up at some point.
Oh yeah, yeah. That I've heard that. I'm a terrible podcaster in a sense. I don't listen to a lot of podcasts because I work at home, and so I don't have a long commute or a boring job where I can, you know, tune out and put in music I listen to music when I write, but I can't listen to somebody talk and write at the same time. I just kind of, my brain, you know, gets stuck in neutral. And so I've heard other people, like, they say why they like our episodes or actual plays, you know, that comes up every once in a while. People say that, oh, you actually finish things and you actually do this. And a lot of course, the audio quality, the fact that they can understand what's going on. And a lot of it is just the sort of off topic table banter, the fact that we sort of get along with each other and we're kind of lively while we're not playing. You know, we sort of give each other a lot of while we're playing, as you might notice, you know, anyways.
Yeah. You guys are playing characters, and you are characters, so it's fun.
The secret of that is pretty simple, though. We're just overeducated and underambitious nerds. And we're just, a lot of them I met in grad school, a lot of the players I've met in grad school, and even the ones like Tom, who I'd known since high school, he's just a voracious history buff and, you know, has an encyclopedic memory of stand-up comic routines. There's a lot of... verbal banter.
Indeed. Well, hey, I want to ask you about game design, because that's kind of one of the big things that we do here. Jason and I still are kind of new at this, and we keep talking about different ways to approach mechanics and game design, and, you know, theme versus mechanics. So wanted to ask you, how do you come at coming up with a new game idea?
Well, the idea is obviously the easiest part. I mean, because
it's true.
That's, you know, it's so easy to come up with something that would be interesting. It's all about how well you execute it. I mean, actually, I just recorded an episode last night. I haven't posted it yet, where we talk literally about a simple idea executed well is infinitely better than a brilliant idea executed poorly. So, for me to come up with the idea is usually I do the thing where I just think of a concept that hasn't really been explored in gaming. You know, the classic idea being the sort of superhero base, which is the basis of my new Kickstarter Base Raiders, where it's this trope that I feel is sort of criminally underused in the superhero genre, that of the lair, the hideout, the fortress of solitude, the Batcave, that kind of thing. And so a major concept in gaming is, of course, the dungeon crawl going. So why not combine the two, superhero dungeon crawling? So it's taking, for me, I just come up with one novel idea or twist and sort of explore that. I know people have different approaches that, you know, a lot of game designers, I think, go with the world building thing, where like you're in the kingdom of Malash, and there's the amulet of Yendor, and there's these gods, and there's this thing, and the dwarves here don't have beards, but they're purple, and they levitate, and elves are different a little bit. And they kind of come up with these very, very complex ideas, very, very, or not even ideas, it's this complex world, and they're trying to sell this world. And I kind of never really get into that as a gamer, because it's hard to sell a setting to my players. You know, I vastly prefer games that have some sort of idea to them rather than are focused on a setting, if that makes sense. But yeah. Anyway, so the idea is the easiest part. And I write them whenever I come up with something. I sort of think about something that's unexpected, or I look at, you know, I do a lot of research too, just sort of keeping up with news and trends, like the topics I'm interested in. Like one thing I'm interested in is architecture and design. So I read, I subscribe to blogs like Building Blog, where you get all these great ideas coming at you, like Project Ice Forum, which was a U.S. Army base in Greenland in the Cold War. So it's like, oh wow, that's a setting right there. That's a great idea for a scenario. So, you know, they just come at you from everywhere. You just have to remember them and then follow through, which is the real trick.
Yeah, so. Yeah, no kidding. That follow through, right. It's tough.
That seems to be the hardest part, right?
Yeah, making that good on your idea.
Yeah. No, that is the sort of bugaboo of, you know, people, of writing or game design or any creative project, is just finishing it. I mean, well, finishing it, and then I think, you know, there is sort of the secondary problem, the twin problem, the other side of that coin, which is stopping. Like, once, it's good if you can carry through and finish a project or whatever, but you have to recognize when to let go and when to start something new. Like, I know one guy in particular in my, area, Springville, Missouri, and he made this sci-fi post-apocalyptic film, and it's pretty good for, a very low budget, practically no budget movie. He made it just with whatever he could scrap, change he could scrap up. But he's been working on it, and he's already released it, and he is, I don't know what he's doing, but he has launched, he's worked for 5 years, and it's been done for like 2 or 3 years, but he's trying to fine tune it or get the shoot new shots and mm-hmm. get better music and just, and a lot of people, I see a lot of creative people who have like hung up on their perfect idea, I got this idea for a game, I got this idea for a novel, and then they work on it forever and they never do anything else. And my last project was Zombies of the World, and now that's done, that's out there. So now I'm working on Base Raiders. I just got to keep moving on. So that's, I don't know.
That's one thing I think that we talk about with our show that's been really helpful for us, because we're constantly forced to come up with a new pitch for a new game. So, that kind of organically allows us to, sometimes too much, to have to focus on a bunch of different ideas at once. But that's a good point. It's a very good point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see that a lot, with like the people who, like, there's sort of three levels of people. The people who want to do stuff, but they never have the energy or the follow through. And, they're just kind of, I'd like to be a writer, blah, blah, blah. Well, then just write. There's no secret key. There's no secret to it. There's no, guild that you have to join or, quest you have to go through. You don't have to, slay a dragon in the dungeons of Yendor or whatever in order to be a writer. Just write. But once you write, you need to be able to finish a project and move on to something else. If you want to be successful, you can't just do one thing. You have to keep working and trying new things and trying new projects and just keep moving forward. I mean, if you look at the careers of any sort of successful writer or creative person, almost never do they just do one masterpiece and that's it. They create a lot of material in their careers, even, relatively like filmmakers, even like Stanley Kubrick, he only did like, a dozen films, but he was working on projects he never got to try. He tried to get more done. He's always trying something new, and I think that's really essential. You have to recognize there's sort of your project's never going to be absolutely perfect. You have to abandon it at some point. You just have to let go and go on. So
yeah, and I've heard the same thing about painters, like Monk, who did the Scream. For every masterpiece, there's 75 or 100 smaller versions of that, where the artist is getting ready for the big one.
Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, and I see, and the reason I think it's in particular in game design, because a lot of game designers, they get their D&D campaign and it's awesome and they run it and they want to make it into their own game or their own role-playing game, and then they just spend forever doing that. They just spend forever trying to get it, writing just hundreds of thousands of words for it, and they just, it becomes this incredibly convoluted thing. And they're never satisfied with it. They always want to keep working on it, trying to improve it. And it's just like, it's okay to be anxious. It's okay to have anxiety about releasing it or making it public or whatever. But, why are you doing this if you never want anyone to see it, if you're just going to keep working on it forever? So, So that's sort of the difference, I think, between the people who never do anything and then kind of the journeymen and the actual true professionals. The true professionals will know the true professionals are the people who can do more than one project at once. I mean, like, if you look at someone like Kenneth Hite or Greg Stolze, they're working on, it seems like 10 projects at once, because they release so much material. And the more you write, the more you create, the more you design, the better you get, because the more you learn about your own process and the feedback you get from people is invaluable. So because game designs, they're never going to be ready unless you playtest them. I mean, that's how it's a little different from writing. Writing, you can just write and then get it edited, but it's not games. You have no idea how good they're going to be until you actually playtest them, until you actually get them in front of players. Like Tom, my co-host, just playtested a scenario and he was really anxious about it. He wanted to kind of like, I don't want to. He just kind of like, towards the end, it's like, this went totally off the rails. I had no idea how to end this. Well, Tom, it's called Cthulhu. Just throw the monster at us. We'll be fine. and you know, you'll kill all of us, and that'll be it. And I'm totally fine with him. I don't like my character. He's a very nasty person. I hope he dies. But you know, we were playing bloodthirsty mercenaries in South America, and so. But Tom learned from that, and he's perfected his scenario. You can see it in the actual play podcast. He does this Divine Fire scenario, yeah. Which is a World War II Call of Cthulhu scenario. And in the first version of that, we were German soldiers going to this scientific laboratory out in the middle of the wilderness, you know, this isolated research camp or whatever you want to call it. And there's, of course, strange things going on. And it's kind of awkward because we're all soldiers, and we have to follow the chain of command, and it was fun. But then I suggest, well, why don't we be all, you know, prisoners sent there to work? You know, we're slave labor basically. And when we get there, the guard dies, and we're like left in this camp. We don't know what the hell's going on, and that way we're all equal. You know, nobody's in charge of anybody. So as player characters, we can wander around, do whatever we want, and that worked a lot better. And there are some other things that he did that improved the quality of the scenario, and. So that's just, you know, iterations, kind of like in software design.
Yeah.
So.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Excellent. Yeah. We do the same thing. Iterate on ideas over and over and over and over again until you either figure out how it works or you realize it's not going to work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can't be too precious about your material. You can't be too, a lot of the people get very, I think, especially with people who are starting out, they get very sensitive and connected to their own work. The idea that if somebody criticizes this game I've written, you know, then they're criticizing me and I'm no good and I don't know what I'm doing. I should just give up, you know? Well, mm-hmm. No, you just have to throw it out there, see how it works, and then work on it some more. And it's not a personal reflection on you, your worth as a person, if your game doesn't work out the way you do. I mean, like Killsplosion, which I designed last year, was my first sort of standalone game, is a flawed game. I mean, I think I had some interesting good ideas in it, but now that I've run it several times, I've play tested it, I've gotten feedback from players, I kind of realized what I did wrong. Well, I realized I needed to change into a miniatures game, you know, basically a role-playing game, because that's really what it is. And but you know, that works, and I need to That's valuable feedback, and I'm certainly going to use that for base raiders. Like base raiders, Killsplosion made me realize I'm much more of not so much of a new game design person. Like there are some people who, like Greg Stolze, who can just create a new system out of, you know, that just pluck it from their head. Ha ha! Here it is, these new rules that are great and mechanically, it's mathematically balanced and everything. I'm not that guy. And then here's great setting material, and here's all this other stuff. I can do everything. I'm not that guy. It's much better. I find it a lot easier to work in a existing rules engine, you know, some sort of existing system that mm-hmm. already has, like, here's how you do combat, here's how you do skill checks and everything like that. And I prefer to create new material for a set of rules. That's why I'm using Fate, because that's open gaming license, and I think it works in particular for base raiders because of some of the concepts I have in it. But I find that a lot better than trying to create some sort of new superpower system mm-hmm. from scratch by myself.
No need to reinvent the wheel.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, there's always a way, like, it depends on what you're trying to do with the game. Some games really do need specific, you know, new rule set if you're trying to do something interesting mechanically. Like, a lot of the indie RPGs will have rules for trust or for, you know, like, fiascos, you know, sort of screwed up relationship system.
Yeah.
I'm hearing good things about the drama system, you know, Hill Folk. So, you know, there are reasons to create a new game system, but only if your central idea of what you're trying to achieve as a game designer merits the extra work. I mean, for me, Base Raiders is pretty much like I wouldn't say a standard superhero setting, but it works within the framework of the superhero genre very easily. I'm not trying to radically somebody described it as a mercenary version of the planet of the comic Planetary, and I find that pretty fair. So, you know, yeah, you could see that as a comic book. So I'm not trying to, like, say superpowers are all metaphor for your oppressed psyche, and, you know, it's all conflict because of Jungian, you know, struggles within yourself. And, like, no, I'm just like guys stealing in a an abandoned super base. So, you know, I'm keeping it kind of simple. So
sure. Now, okay, so Base Raiders, Killsplosion, Zombies of the World, these are projects that you've done through Kickstarter, through crowdfunding, right?
Not Zombies of the World.
Oh,
Zombies
no,
of the
I'm
World
sorry.
I financed them on my own through credit cards and saved up money and all that junk. So
okay.
Killsplosion, also the New World primers, the PDFs are available for the D&D New World campaign.
Right.
Those are all those were all ransom projects. In fact, I was using Fundable before that went away, and so I was using Fundable before Kickstarter.
Okay.
I was one of the people to launch. I was in Kickstarter in 2009, right after it started up. So
okay, what was your first crowdfunded project? Then I should say, I wouldn't just say Kickstarter.
World campaign.
It was okay.
The New Campaign Primer. Okay. Which, if you go to the Slang Design, you know, the Role Playing Public Radio's website, there's four PDFs from it. The New World Primer, the Goblin Hulk, Codex of War, and Ruins of Lemuria. And each one, like, the New World Primer was, I think I only asked for $450. And, like, that was to pay an artist money for that, and so that I'd have some pocket change for hosting, you know, the website. And
sure.
that was about it. So that was kind of an experiment, and that worked pretty well. And then the Goblin Hulk, and then it was the Goblin Hulk. Yeah, the Goblin Hulk was the one that where Fundable itself was dissolving. Fundable.org was dissolving, and like the people who owned it got into some feud. So there's kind of some uncertainty if I was going to get my money or not. But fortunately.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, no, if you go to Fundable.org, like Wikipedia page, I think they have a whole thing about their conflict between the people who were running it at the time, and it's pretty funny. But so after that, then my first one was the new Codex of War. That was the first one I did on Kickstarter, and then Ruins of Lemuria, and then there was the Killsplosion last year, and now this year I'm doing Base Raiders.
Yeah.
So that's the history, the chronology of it.
Okay. So so obviously you're a fan of crowdfunding, right?
Yes, of course.
Yeah, naturally, right.
He's like, no, I hate it.
I hate when people give me money. Yeah.
I like it before it was so mainstream.
Oh, terrible. So you're a crowdfunding hipster.
Yeah. He's like, I liked Kickstarter before it was Kickstarter.
Yeah.
Back when there was another site called Fundable.
Well, so, no one involved in Fundable was using Kickstarter. Kickstarter was just like, people like, hey, let's do that, but not be idiots like Fundable.
Right.
Good for them for doing that.
So one of the things that I constantly have bouncing around in my head is this worry that Kickstarter and this crowdfunding idea, that it's just a fad right now, that it's not going to be around 10 years from now or even 5 years from now. And that if I'm going to seriously consider self-publishing stuff, am I going to have this resource available to me to fund projects in the future? I don't know if you have any thoughts on the sustainability of this.
I've been thinking about that myself. I mean, because, you know, there has obviously been some controversy, and you do see Kickstarter haters, especially in the video game sites. A lot of the video game Kickstarters are getting a lot of criticism because, a lot of the hardware projects, I think, are getting a lot of criticism for under-delivering or non-delivering, you know, like the new Android video game system, OU, or Oya, or whatever it's pronounced, you know, raised like $9 million, and people just looking at it and just like, you know, they're only producing 60,000 units, who would, you know, produce for that, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, that there are some valid concerns there, that there is this chance that people are just going to be ripped off and people thinking it's a pre-ordering system. But it depends on what you're trying to do. I think for tabletop games, it's just been great because it allows original concepts to come forward that would never be funded by traditional publishing, because traditional publishers, especially in tabletop games, are just very small, and the bigger ones have their own properties. They're not going to like, oh, you got this great idea, here's your check and we shall finance and do this. No, they're going to do, well, we've got expensive property A, you know, War Trek Hammer Star Wars thing, you know, that is worth $1 million, is a, you know, multi-million dollar franchise with millions of fans, we're going to do games based on that because we have that license. And and the medium-sized companies started with their own IP, and they're not going to let some outsiders. So if you're an outsider and you have no connections or minimal connections, it's your only way to, like, you know, and let the free market speak. Now, I think there's going to be some maturing, especially when people sort of get used to the idea of Kickstarter. And I think we're already starting to see that. But I think people that get good reputations, game designers that have solid histories, can use this to finance interesting projects. Now, I think some of the hype means that you may not necessarily be seeing the big numbers or as many big numbers as you do now or in the last year. But I don't think it's going to collapse entirely. I think it's going to stay around because it's just such a good idea and people are responding to it so well. I mean, we're sort of in a little – tabletop games are in a sort of a little niche that isn't going to be affected by, like, you know, hardware or larger projects. I mean, these are real creative – this is what Kickstarter was meant for, these sort of small creative projects. It wasn't meant to fund necessarily some gadget that could have been funded traditionally through investors.
Yeah.
Eventually people are going to – there's going to be a sort of stabilization for it because, I mean, there's a lot of people – there's a lot of fans for the tabletop games. And they want to see new material, and so they have the dollars. They have the demand. There's a demand for it. There's clearly a demand for it because of all the funded projects that are going through. Sure. But I think we're in a sense sort of lucky if there's any sort of collapse or bubble bursting. I think tabletop games won't be heavily affected by it just because it's not such a small amount of money compared. You know, we're not raising $9 million or a few million dollars for one game. You know, I'd be surprised if tabletop games raised more than a few million dollars in a year. I mean, I don't know the numbers, and a lot of that's for board games or for miniatures. Mm-hmm. So barring a lot of fraud from tabletop games designers or companies, which I don't think is going to happen, I think we're going to be pretty stable. I think there will be some changes. I think the formula is going to get refined. I think, you know, they'll probably try and, like, separate shipping charges from the actual money you raise. You know, like, one problem right now is, I think, if you have a book and you're selling it, like what I'm doing, for $30, and you say, well, it takes $10, around $10 to ship internationally. You know, it usually costs more. Occasionally it costs less, almost always more, but like $10 I can handle. I'll just eat the extra couple bucks. But then that person puts down $40, that whole $40 counts against the Kickstarter, when it really should only be $30 should count against the Kickstarter.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah. I think they're probably going to change that pretty soon if they have. They might have already. But I think that's really something to be aware of. And there's a lot of minor refinements to the process, and there's certainly going to be more competition from, like, Indiegogo and a couple other sites. So yeah, I mean, it depends on what you're trying to do, and I think tabletop games are going to be pretty safe for the most part. So I think it's something. The thing is, though, you're going to have to be someone, either you're going to have to build up a reputation. I think reputation is going to become more and more important. Customers are going to be more and more discerning. Like, I'm really fortunate that I have the podcast and I have the history of doing this, mm-hmm. so people trust that I'm going to deliver on what I promise and what I, you know, say, hey, I'll have a book for you next year, and it'll be awesome. I'll have all the stuff in it, mm-hmm. and, you know, a lot of people can't just appear out of the wilderness, like, I shall give you the greatest thing ever. Yeah. You know, then they disappear with however much money. So
yeah, and that's one of one of our thoughts here. I mean, and we are always want to be transparent with our audience, of course. That, you know,
yeah.
One of our goals in doing our podcast is to share this entire experience with an audience and with people, and we're constantly asking for feedback from people, and we want to try and connect with the community out there, so that when we do get to a point where we have a project ready to go, so that people can find out about it, and we just have some reach into the community.
Yeah, you definitely need to. It's all about connecting to fans, connecting to the people that are supporting you, and having that sort of direct honesty. So there's trust built up, you know, and. And there are going to be people who are going to be critical and are going to be demanding. You know, a lot of it's just community relations 101. So yeah, if you have any experience doing that, you know, managing message boards or, you know, a fan base of any sort, you just kind of have to do that sort of work for it and just kind of walk the line. So, I mean, I think it makes the people creating games more accountable to the people. And it also, I think one thing that I really like about Kickstarter is that it shows game designers what the market actually is. Like I think a lot of companies create a product out of the void, like, hey, let's do a game about steam-powered steamrollers. And you just steamroll things, and that's the board game, and that'll be great. You're just steamrolling steampunks. And, you know, they spend all this money for steampunk steamrollers, and they just, like, oh, you steamroll orphan children. Yeah, that's it. That's it. You're an evil tycoon, and you're steamrolling children.
I would buy that game.
Well... Yeah, most people do actually kickstart that game. But, like, most people, you know, it comes out and it's just a terrible game and nobody wants it, and they wasted 50 grand, you know, or 10 grand for a book or whatever else. And Kickstarter will actually show, oh, wow, there's a lot of demand for this book, or there's no demand for this book, or there's just enough demand. So it's invaluable market research to show if you can't raise a Kickstarter for this concept, maybe you should rethink of it, because the market's not going to be disproportionately different than the Kickstarter. I mean, the Kickstarter market isn't as the same as the general retail market, but there's certainly a connection there. So... how close it is, it depends on what you're talking about. I think tabletop games are going to be pretty close, because most tabletop gamers are pretty connected to the internet. They're pretty, a lot of them, they might not spend time on RPG.net or ianworld.org or listen to RPG podcasts, but they talk to people who do, or they know friends, you know, who are connected to that kind of stuff. And they start to keep up with the trends, and they keep up with the rumors, and
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. Few last questions for you then before we call it a night here. You have done the self-publishing thing several times now. So yeah. What should we be watching out for? What should we, or I guess, what do you wish you had known in advance?
Well, one of the things I'm still working on is, well, marketing distribution. I mean, that for me, like, Zombies of the World is, you know, critically acclaimed. It's gotten great reviews from, like, Kenneth Haidt and a lot of other book reviewers. It's won national book awards, you know, the Benjamin Franklin Award for Best Humor and a couple others. And it's, you know, this great book, but it's really hard to market it and distribute it because bookstores... You know, there's only one chain of bookstores of note, really, you know, Barnes & Noble. And while it's in Barnes & Noble, how do you sell to all these other bookstores? So, you know, if you're self-publishing, think a lot about what kind of demand there is for that book. Like, Base Raiders, Kickstarter, again, is incredibly valuable because now I'll have a much better sense of how much kind of demand there is. So I can print exactly how many I need and not have, you know, cases and cases of books left over you know, I'm going to take me years to sell. So with that, so of course that's with print products. So for you, for it depends on what you're doing. Know what your market is and have realistic expectations about what kind of demand you're going to do. And then again, the other thing is just technical stuff, you know, knowing how to export to ebook format. Zombies of the World is kind of unusual because there's a lot of graphic, you know, color illustrations in it. So that's very hard to do in a standard ebook format and have it look interesting because, you know, ebooks are mostly text only, you know, they're yeah. sort of, just strip down HTML files. So that's that, you know, aside from all the thing, making a book is incredibly hard. You know, well, it's very hard. You have to edit, you have to write it, blah, blah, blah. But then marketing, distributing it is just as hard as writing, and it requires an entirely different skill set. So be aware of what you're going up against when you're self-publishing. So yeah, that would be the key advice if to anybody breaking into that. Be aware of how – don't underestimate it, that marketing distribution is a bear. And it is a solved problem, but it requires a lot of energy and money and – some money at least and time. So you're not going to be overnight hit. You know, you're not going to be the next Twilight.
So that is terrifying advice. what's the positive side?
Well, the positive side is you have control over it. Any money you make is yours. You know, you don't have to wait for the okay of a publisher. You aren't subject to someone else's whims for the history, you know, the future of your book. So, you know, if you have a great story or something like that and you own it, then you can try and sell it or try and spin it off, make it into a video game or, you know, something like that. And you know, it just have realistic expectation about your book. If you're somebody nobody knows about and you write this great novel, you know, it's not going to sell many copies unless you're that, you know, one in a million Amanda Hawking or someone like that. You know, if you want to make money like self-publishing fiction, write romance or erotic stuff. I mean, seriously, that's you laugh, but it's true.
No, I believe it.
We laugh because we believe you.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you I mean, it's the thing is there's no longer a stigma against self-publishing.
Yeah.
Because so that's the upside is that if you self-publish, people aren't going to automatically assume you're just some idiot. There's no vanity presses are, you know, not what people think of now. So if you self-publish, it can pay huge dividends in a lot of other ways, not necessarily to your bank account, but to your credibility. You know, if you're a professional in some field and you write something about, you know, a book that gets well reviewed on a given topic, then people will, you know, respect you for that, and you can leverage it in other ways. You can use it to get a job with a publishing deal with another publishing house. See, I've got an even greater book in mind. You know,
yeah.
And
so it's on 100% of the risk, but you also get 100% of the reward.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's very true.
Right on. Well, hey Ross, thank you so much again for talking to us tonight. We really appreciate it. The campaign right now is for Base Raiders on Kickstarter, and by when this posts, I think you'll have about a week left.
Yeah, it ends on the midnight on the 24th.
Okay.
So. November 24th. So,
excellent.
Buy my book.
Yeah, right. We'll definitely link all your stuff in the show notes for this episode. So, guys, check it out.
Check out Base Raiders. Buy a copy of Zombies of the World. Listen to RPPR. What else can we plug for you, sir?
I do a podcast for Arc Dream. That's a publishing company I write for occasionally. They have a podcast called Unspeakable, which is the podcast for The Unspeakable Oath at Call of Cthulhu Magazine. And we just put out a new episode a little while ago with some of the authors of Delta Green. So if you're into Call of Cthulhu and horror gaming, you should give Unspeakable a listen.
Excellent.
Yeah. Awesome.
And you had done a Monsters and Other Childish Things book for Arc Dreams, right?
Two of them, actually. Curriculum Ooh. Conspiracy and Road Trip. Road Trip was nominated for an Innie for Best Adventure last year, but of course Pathfinder was nominated for it, so they won.
Yeah.
On everything they are nominated for because they are Pathfinder.
Right. But we forgot all about it. You guys, Role Playing Public Radio, won the Innie for Best Podcast last year, right?
This year, yes.
This year, 2012. Congratulations on that.
Thank you. It was very we had some great competition, you know, really, really, really well done blogs. And I was very, very, we were very fortunate. We have such a supportive fan base. So I had them play the theme song from The Room as I walked up to get my reward. So I felt that was appropriate. So that's kind of the official movie of RPPR.
Nice.
So
excellent. Yeah. All right, Ross, thanks again. We really appreciate it, man. Have a good one.
Thanks.
All right.
Building the Game is a co-production of Imminent Entertainment and Poorly Designed Studios.